The military crisis with which Britain is now faced, having been forced out of Europe, is met by an acceleration of domestic mobilisation and overseas spending in an effort to prepare the country to win the war on its own. Military recruitment accelerates, large quantities of industrial supplies and raw materials are ordered from America, exhausting Britain's reserves of foreign currency and leaving it reliant on US financial aid from the spring of 1941. Britain's strategists become more committed during this period to their own aerial war, a bombing campaign initially directed against German industry, but ultimately aimed at cities as a whole as the only target that there's really a hope of hitting. So bad is the standard of bomb aiming on all sides in the 1940s. The British stick with bombing as a means to wear down German resistance before their armies return to mainland Europe. This is very expensive and a big gamble as a strategy, because it involves cutting-edge military technology. And one of the things that I think we're all aware of, even now, looking at things like aircraft carriers or communications equipment for the Ministry of Defence, is that anything that's cutting-edge and military is expensive. It gets more expensive. It's difficult to make. Sometimes it's unreliable. It's, you know, it's taking a gamble on something that isn't fully proven. But bombing is also a means to save the lives of British soldiers by avoiding the sort of attritional trench warfare that had characterised the previous conflict. Creating this sort of effort requires an enormous shift of resources from civilian consumption and the export industries to military production. This shift is made much easier by the provision of US assistance through Lend-Lease at the start of 1941, because it means that Britain doesn't have to pay dollars for US goods up front. But converting the country for war in this fashion also means depriving civilians of much of the range and choice of consumer goods, clothes, shirts, stockings, shoes, and foodstuffs that they'd enjoyed in the 1930s. This is not the same as saying that Britain goes short of food. Far from it. In global terms, I mean, I think one of the ways that the war is remembered still is in terms of food shortage. But I think we've got to be quite careful about what we mean by that. Despite the attacks of German U-boats on merchant shipping and the transport requirements of a global war, and it's actually the transporting men and material around the world actually has a bigger impact on what you can bring into the country than the ships sunk by German U-boats. One of the remarkable things about Britain as a major force in the world economy is its ability to change its imports to much more nutritionally dense products, while also expanding domestic agricultural production. So even though the volume of food imported decreases, its value remains much more constant. So rather than importing fresh beef, Britain imports a lot more tinned meat of all sorts, which occupies less space in shipping holds. But food and clothing both become scarcer, while at the same time, the government is pumping a huge amount of money into the economy as it pays for the production of aircraft, tanks, planes and bombs, with the result that inflation continues to rise very steeply. By the winter of 1940-41, the cost of living index had gone up by about a quarter since the start of the war. Despite the change of government, however, there's relatively little additional state action for most of this aerial urban war period to cushion the impact of inflation or to prevent the development of a wage price spiral in which wage demands go up in response to an increase in the cost of living, and as more money chases less goods, so inflation skyrockets. Only in the spring of 1941, in a sense after the shock of summer 1940 is over, does the state introduce a range of inflation-busting measures. Much heavier taxation that spread more widely over the country, forced saving, regulation of production for sale to civilians, and a formal programme of subsidising food, as well as, over the course of 1941, a dramatic extension of rationing to cover clothes and many more items of food on a points basis. Now, this is sold in terms of ensuring fair shares for all in a period of shortage. But to be honest, what it's designed to do is to protect the British people from their own greed, because they're all earning more money and there are less goods. But if you could trust everybody only to buy their fair share, then you wouldn't need rationing. This is just part of a huge extension of state intervention in 1941. Which also includes the move towards the conscription of women for industry in the armed forces, compulsory service for civilians in civil defence or the Home Guard, and a vast survey of agricultural land designed to weed out inefficient farmers. So I think what you see at the start of 1941 is a real gear change in terms of what the state is demanding of people and how far it's trying to go in terms of intervening in their lives in order to protect them from some of the effects of those demands. Now, some of those measures indicate the influence of the Labour Party within the new coalition, but they don't represent a shift towards socialist planning of the sort to which Labour had been committed in the 1930s. Rather, this is a set of compromises between competing views of how the economy should work under the necessity of the wartime search for victory. And for British civilians, I think this is one of the hardest periods of the war, the winter of 1940-41. Not only are they living under almost constant fear of enemy attack, almost wherever they are, even if those attacks don't actually come to pass, the fear is there, but they are also experiencing rising costs and growing shortages. At the same time, however, the expansion of the armed forces and of the munitions factories means that unemployment rapidly diminishes.